Everybody had a good night's sleep. Certainly got a beautiful day today. And, you know, it's kind of tough to compete with God. He's doing a good job out there today. So it's a pleasure to be with you today. We're going to look at two different things. In the first hour, we're going to look at the way in which the Gospels work and deal particularly with those differences that people tend to push and press on to try and undercut what's going on, particularly with Jesus and the Gospels. We're going to be focused on Jesus and the Gospels. And then in the second hour, I'm going to talk about a topic that probably most of you all will not know very much about, and it is about all those other Gospels that you sometimes hear about, particularly on television around Easter or Christmas time when people want to bring up issues related to the development of early Christianity and want to suggest that there are more than the four Gospels out there. So we're going to take a look and get a feel for what that material is, where it comes from, that kind of thing, so that you know a little bit about it when you interact with people on it. So let me start with our Gospel roots. I talked a little bit about this last night, but I want to fill in some detail. Luke 1 and 2, we'll take a look at that passage in just a minute, speaks of written accounts, things that are set to hand about Jesus in verse 1, as well as oral tradition, the things that were passed on to us by those who were ministers and eyewitnesses of the Word. So verse 1 of Luke 1 talks primarily about written sources, and verse 2 of chapter 1 of Luke alludes to the oral tradition about Jesus that was circulating through the church. And the reason I have Acts 1 there is because this idea of oversight in the tradition is related to the way the replacement for Judas is described in Acts 1. You remember when they went to replace Judas and Matthias ended up being elected in his place, the requirement for that apostle was that he would have been with us from the beginning, which is a way of saying he really knew who Jesus was, what he taught, etc. So it roots the oversight of the church and the oversight in addition of this tradition in someone who has a deep, long experience with Jesus. So the oral word was seen as a living word. We talked about this last night. So the recording of the Gospels did not start until the apostles started to die off. One of the questions you sometimes get is, why did it take 30 to 40 years before someone sat down and started to write a gospel? You think they would do that pretty much immediately. Well, the answer is twofold. One, you're in an oral culture in which orality is honored, and so the value of the living word is honored. And the second reason is, once you start to lose those witnesses and direct access to those witnesses, then you're going to write down what it is that they taught us. And so as the apostles begin to drop off the scene down the road, you get the recording of various gospels. In the tradition, Mark is said to have interacted with Peter before Peter died. And so the recording of the gospels didn't start until the apostles started to die off. Now, when we talk about sources for the Gospels, where does our material come from that we have in the New Testament? Well, for most New Testament scholars, although this is still somewhat discussed, the first Gospel to be written was the Gospel of Mark. Our canonical order, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, comes from the order that Augustine thought the Gospels were written in and became kind of the official canonical order. And Matthew, for a long time, was regarded as the earliest gospel written. But for reasons that I don't have time to go into in great detail, basically Mark's outline is the one that governs all three gospels. And most people looking at Mark think that he's either the first gospel or the last gospel as a result. Just because of the nature of the contents that he has, what isn't used by him if he comes later. Some people say, well, if he's the third gospel, there are a lot of omissions that are hard to explain. There's no version of the Sermon on the Mount, for example. There's no indication about any infancy material in Mark. If Mark is third, that's hard to explain. The other thing that's interesting is that some people thought, well, Mark was kind of a Reader's Digest version of the other Gospels. But in fact, in the passages where Mark overlaps with Matthew and Luke, he's longer and gives more detail than the other Gospels, so that doesn't look like a Reader's Digest version. So all this suggests Mark's not third, so he's more likely to be first. So Mark is considered our source for a source for Matthew and Luke. Then there's material called Q. You might sometimes hear about this. Again, if you watch television, they talk about the Gospels. They'll talk about this thing called Q. Well, what is it? Q stands, we think, for the German word Quelle, which is the word source. And Q is a collection of teaching. There are about 200 verses, 200 to 235 verses, in Matthew and Luke, mostly Jesus' teaching, that overlap. They aren't in Mark. And the argument is, this is fully about 20% of each of those Gospels. And the argument is, Matthew didn't use Luke, and Luke didn't use Matthew. Again, if you compare the infancy material, you can get a feel for why someone might think that. If you look at how the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain operate in relationship to each other and the differences between them, you'll get the sense that Luke didn't use Matthew and Matthew didn't use Luke. But then you've got a problem of, where did these 200 to 235 verses come from? They had to come from somewhere. And so what scholars have posited, and it is a hypothesis, but there's some good reason for it, is that there was a source of Jesus' teachings circulating through the church. Now, whether it was written or oral could be discussed. But there was a source of Jesus' teaching, an anthology of Jesus' teaching, if you will, that circulated through the church, and people call this entity, this thing, Q, and it's made up of these overlapping verses between Matthew and Luke without Matthew and Luke having used one another. There might be some questions about that when we have the question time. The gospel authors, as I stated last night, two gospels have apostolic roots, Matthew and John. Two involve people who are close to the apostles, Mark with an association to Peter, Luke with an association to Paul. And what's interesting, I think this is fascinating, Justin Martyr, over a dozen times in his writings, he's a second century church father, called the Gospels the apostolic memoirs. What do you call a gospel before the name gospel kind of stuck to what they were? The name gospel that we get is used in the introduction to Mark and is used in the headings that go over the manuscripts that we have to the Gospels, but those headings, at least as we have them, come from the 2nd and 3rd centuries. So the question is, what did you call a Gospel to identify it before the name Gospel stuck to all four? And the answer is, at least in the 2nd century is any indication, is they were the apostolic memoirs about Jesus, which is actually a nice way to think about them. It is the tradition that's come to us through the apostles and their memories about who Jesus was. Thus, we talked about eyewitnesses and memories and orality last night. So that idea comes from the writings of Justin Martyr. He uses it in a text I'm going to show you in a minute from Dialogues 103, plus several more times. I think 17 times total he calls the gospel apostolic memoirs. Okay, here is the text in Luke that I mentioned. Now, many have undertaken to compile an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. If you look at this literally in Greek, the literal way it would translate would be, now many have taken to hand the things that have been filled among us, have put down on paper, if you will. So that's why we're talking about written materials. Like the accounts passed on to us, that's technical Jewish language for oral tradition. Like the accounts passed on to us through those who were eyewitnesses and servants of the word from the beginning. So those are the oral materials rooted in witnesses. So it seemed good to me as well, because I followed all things carefully from the beginning, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know for certain the things you were taught. Luke's gospel is written to reassure Theophilus, who probably is a Gentile, who has come into the faith and asked, and he's probably wrestling with, did I make the right decision? In that, he's a Gentile in what was originally a Jewish movement, and there are a lot of Jewish people pushing against the church, persecuting it on the one hand, And it's this Jew-Gentile mix, which culturally doesn't work on the other hand. At least in most contexts it wouldn't work. And so there's this set of tensions about, have I done the right thing? And the Gospel of Luke is designed to assure Theophilus, yes, what he's been taught is so. What he was taught about Jesus is really so, etc. So that's the introduction to Luke. This is the only gospel writer that tells us anything about how he went about or what the resources were, what the sources were for what he was doing. Matthew doesn't have anything like this. Mark doesn't, and neither does John. Okay, here's the passage in Justin Martyr that refers to the Apostolic Memoirs. This is Dialogues 103:19, for those of you who want to have your devotions later. And so here we go. For in the memoirs, which I say were drawn up by his apostles and those who followed him, it is recorded that his sweat fell down like drops of blood while he was praying and saying, if it be possible, let this cup pass. Obviously an allusion to the prayer at Gethsemane before Jesus goes to the cross. This is a passage that at least this detail about sweating like drops of blood is a passage that comes out of the Gospel of Luke. And he doesn't identify the author of the gospel. He simply refers to it as the Apostolic Memoirs. And this is the way he habitually refers to the gospels. All right, some data for you. Okay, no teacher is worth his salt unless he makes you do a little math. So let's take a look at this. Here are the number of verses in each of the synoptic gospels. Mark has 661. Matthew, 1,068. Luke has 1,149. In fact, Luke, you may not be aware of this, Luke actually has written more of the New Testament than any other writer, even more than Paul. It's not by much. It's like 30% versus 29%, but Luke is actually the most prolific writer in the New Testament, in part because his gospel is the longest gospel. John is not on this list, but I think John has somewhere around 800 verses total. So, the use of Mark, this is one of the reasons we think Mark is the first gospel. 92% of Mark's verses are in Matthew, and 50% are in Luke. I've talked about these 235 verses that are shared between Matthew and Luke, 22% and 20% of those two gospels respectively. 29%, virtually 3 verses out of 10, in Matthew is unique to Matthew. 50% of Luke is unique to him. In fact, if we didn't have Luke, we wouldn't have many of Jesus' parables. Much of that material, that unique material in Luke, is made up of parables that only Luke tells us. The Good Samaritan, Lazarus and the rich man, the rich fool. These are all parables, the widow who annoys the judge. These are all parables that are unique to Luke's gospel, and they make up a significant portion of the 50% of unique material that Luke gives us. Mark has only, depending on how you count it, sometimes there are questions about whether there's an overlap or not, has only between 4% and 10% unique material. Virtually all of Mark is in the other two synoptic gospels. 28% of Matthew is in both Mark and Luke. 45% of Mark is in both Matthew and Luke. 26% of Luke is in both Matthew and Mark, and 47% of Mark is only also in Matthew. So those are some of our numbers. What does that look like? Well, on a chart, it looks like this. And again, 100% being the gray there, the total gospel. 26% unique to Matthew, about 7% averaging that 4 to 10. Mark, and 50% of Luke. Q, I've already talked about this. About 235 verses are shared between Matthew and Luke. The supposition for Q is that Matthew and Luke did not use one another, so one is not the source for this overlapping material for the other. So then the question becomes, where did this 20% of each gospel come from? About 20%. And what's interesting is, if you look at this material carefully, you will see that there are certain subjects that are consistently addressed within the material. So, for example, John the Baptist and Jesus passages. There are 5 different John the Baptist and Jesus passages that Luke and Matthew share between one another that people think comes from Q. A discussion between Jesus and his disciples. There are different passages about discipleship, about mission. That's what that Luke 10 set of passages is. A discussion about prayer. These are materials that overlap with Matthew. Third set of topics is Jesus interacting with his opponents. A fourth set of topics deals, in fact, the bulk of them deal with where Jesus is teaching some aspect about the future judgment. So not only do we have 235 verses that we're dealing with, but we have 235 verses, most of which deal with specific topic areas. So most people think that Q was kind of an anthology or a collection of Jesus' teaching, having primarily to do with the nature of some of his teaching and his mission, that kind of thing. And only a handful of passages don't fit the patterns of these topics. Okay. Now here's a question. This is kind of a sidebar. I often tell students at the seminary that if I am in an ordination exam, there's one question I'm likely to ask them to see how aware they are of historical discussion. The question goes like this. Without using the Bible and without using the early church fathers, what evidence is there that Jesus existed outside of Christian sources? Okay? It's a simple question. It's an important question because some people out there argue that Jesus is completely made up. He's a myth. Well, if he's completely made up and is a myth, he's not going to show up in outside historical sources. And so, in fact, he does show up in outside historical sources. And I'm going to mention two of them. There are more than this, but there are two very prominent examples. One of these is Jewish and one of these is Roman. The first is Josephus. In Josephus, in a work known as Antiquities. Antiquities is a history of Israel starting from Genesis and going up to the time of Josephus. Josephus was a first century Jewish historian who actually lived with Vespasian, the emperor, after he was captured during the war that Rome had in Israel, where they overran Jerusalem and sacked the temple in AD 70. Well, in 67, Josephus was the general of Jewish troops at a place called Gamla. Interesting place, placed on a hill that oversaw a huge range of territory around it, and eventually the Romans put it under siege, surrounded it, isolated it, and eventually they surrendered. And the general at that location was Josephus. So not only was he a defender of Judaism, he came to be an exile in Rome and lived with the emperor. And here's how that happened. Josephus predicted that Vespasian, who was the general at the time during the war, the lead general for Rome, would become emperor. And so when Vespasian did become emperor, he says, I want that Jewish guy in my house. Josephus ended up living with Vespasian and ended up writing a lot of works that defended and explained Judaism to his Greco-Roman captors. Antiquities was one. Another one was called The Jewish War, in which he explained, don't blame the war on all Jews. It was only a segment of Judaism that created the problems. A third work was called Against Appian. That was an attempt to explain Judaism to Greeks. And then the last work that he wrote was called Life, The Life of Josephus. It was an autobiography in which the theme was, what a great guy I am. So that's Josephus. And in a section of Josephus, there is a citation about Jesus explaining him as one of the rebels during the time when Pilate ruled in Judea. And this passage, as you're going to see as I'm quoting it, has some italics in it because we know it's been fiddled with by Christian copyists, by some of the things that are said, because Josephus was not a Christian. And yet some of the things that are said make him sound like a Christian. So here's the citation as we have it. In Antiquities 18, 63 and 64. Now there was about this time, Jesus, a wise man, first set of italics, if it be lawful to call him a man, suggesting that he's more, and that's why we don't think that goes back to Josephus, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ, second set of italics, that's a confession that he is the Messiah, and Josephus wouldn't have believed that. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of principal men among us, had him condemned to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him. For he appeared to them alive again on the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. Sing the Hallelujah chorus during that part. Okay? That doesn't come from Josephus. That's something a Christian would write. And then, and the tribe of Christians so named for him are not extinct to this day. So that's the citation as we have it. The italicized portions are the portions that most scholars, both classicists and biblical scholars, question go back to Josephus. So what is it that he said? This is a reconstruction of the type of thing Josephus is likely to have originally said when you pull out those parts that clearly look Christian. And it goes something like this. Now there was about this time a source of further trouble. That's the section that we're in. We're dealing with the people who Rome dealt with during Pilate's rule. Jesus, for he was a doer of surprising works. That word for surprising works is the Greek word paradoxon. It means unusual works. It's allusion to Jesus working miracles and his reputation for miracles that he had in the society around him. A teacher of such men has received the truth with pleasure. An alternate way to translate that phrase a little less neutrally is men who welcome strange things. He drew over to him many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles, and when Pilate, at the suggestion of principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him or did not cease to cause trouble, and the tribe of Christians so named for him are not extinct to this day. The citation is important because it says that Jesus existed. It acknowledges the Roman role in the crucifixion. It acknowledges the Jewish leader's role in the crucifixion, and it also explains that the origin of Christians comes from the time when he roamed the earth. So there are four things that are affirmed about Jesus. This is a Jewish historian from the late first century who knew and researched what went on in Judea. In fact, he lived through some of it. And so as a result, this is important testimony to Jesus. The second citation comes from Tacitus, a Roman historian writing in the early 2nd century, who wrote a work called the Annals, and this is in Annals 15:44. They, he's talking about the Christians, got their name from Christ, who was executed by the sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. That's exactly, of course, where the scripture has Jesus located. That checked the pernicious superstition. You can tell that Tacitus doesn't like Christians. Whenever a Roman doesn't like a religious belief, they call it a superstition. But this isn't just a superstition. It's a pernicious superstition. So that's kind of, you know, superstition on steroids, if you want to think of it that way. That checked the pernicious superstition for a short time, but it broke out afresh, not only in Judea, where the fur plague first arose, but in Rome itself, where all horrible and shameful things in the world collect and find a home. Okay, sounds like what someone might say about New York City or Las Vegas or Los Angeles. Anyway, this is about Nero's punishment of Christians. He's describing in AD 64, and the explanation of the fire, actually the longer form of this citation, goes on to talk about the pity that Romans felt for Christians who were blamed for the great fire in Rome, and most people thought that Christians were not responsible for that fire, so they've been unfairly persecuted. This material was written somewhere in the second decade of the second century, AD 115 to 117, and it's a Roman historian confirming that Jesus existed, that his crucifixion took place under Pontius Pilate, and that Tiberius was emperor during that time. So, yet another piece of evidence that Jesus existed, this time coming from a Roman historian, not a Jewish historian, about Jesus. Okay, so that's kind of all backdrop. Now let's talk about what I said we were going to talk about, and that is the way in which the Gospels work and some of these differences that exist between them. And we need to think about what inspiration is by what the Spirit has deposited in our text that we call the Gospels. And that's what I want to look at. And so let me give you some misimpressions that exist. Some of these are conservative misimpressions, and some of them are skeptical misimpressions. For example, how many of you own a Bible with red letters in it? Anyone? Go show those hands. Don't be shy. Okay, it's confession time. Okay, I own a red letter Bible. I'm a proud owner of a red letter Bible. And of course, what does the red letter Bible suggest? The letters are red because that's where Jesus spoke. Okay, so the idea is the red letters give us the very words of Jesus. That's the idea. And there are a couple of issues with this. One is it can tend to suggest that the words of Jesus are more important than the inspired words of the rest of the New Testament. So that's an issue. And the second thing that I'm going to try and show you in the time that we have, the rest of the time that we have today, is that sometimes I'm not getting Jesus in quotation marks as I'm getting Jesus summarized and or paraphrased. And I'm going to try and show this to you in ways that will help you be comfortable with some of the differences you see. We're at the same point of dialogue in a given event, but what is said is slightly different. A second misimpression that the Gospels have is that history equals chronology. For example, remember that in the citation that I read to you from Luke, it says that he's going to give you an ordered account. And most Westerners automatically default and say an ordered account means a chronological account. Well, for the most part, that's true. But it's not completely true. There are places in the New Testament where things are ordered because of topics. I'm going to talk about this a little more later. But in Mark 5, 2, 1 to 3, 5, there are five controversies literally put back to back to one another. They come one right after another in the space of a little more than a chapter of Mark. Luke does the same thing with that material. He gives the same five controversies in the same order. Mark has those controversies spread across four chapters, chapters 8 to 12. Actually, it's part of five chapters. And so, and there are things in between. So sometimes an order is taking place because of topics. Another thing about Luke's order is that Luke's order is a little bit geographical. We start off in Jerusalem, then we go to the ministry in Galilee, we journey from Galilee to Jerusalem, Jesus is crucified in Jerusalem, he extends into Acts, we start off in Jerusalem in Acts, then we go to the edges of Israel, finally we go to the mission to the Gentiles that Paul undertakes, and we're journeying to the ends of the earth until we finally get to Rome. That structure is as much geographical as it is chronological. So there are different ways to order the material. History doesn't always equal chronology. In fact, and I'm going to mention this later, there is a synagogue speech that Jesus gives in Luke 4 that in the other Gospels is located in the middle of their Gospels, Mark 6 and Matthew 13. What's interesting about this text is that in the middle of this text in Luke, Jesus is told, do the miracles that you performed in Capernaum for us. Only there's one problem. In Luke, Jesus hasn't been to Capernaum yet. He doesn't go to Capernaum until the next scene. So what's going on? What looks to have happened is that Luke has taken an event that's later, brought it as the initial event that he talks about at Galilean ministry, as a picture and a model for what the entirety of the Galilean ministry is going to look like. And so it is a text that's moved forward chronologically to give a foretaste of what the character of the entire ministry in that area is going to be like. So there are things like this sometimes going on in the Gospels. And those aren't problems. They're literary moves with the narrative that are important to realize. Another thing that we have to wrestle with, and much of what I'm going to do subsequent to this is going to also try and show this, is there's a difference between accuracy and precision. some parallel accounts in the Gospels, one version is more precise than the other version, even though both are accurate. And I'll talk about that distinction as I go through some of the examples. A misimpression that people have because of inspiration is that when the Gospels retell a story, they have to retell it in exactly the same way. And the fact is, they don't. So we'll talk about that. This is all setting up what I'm about to do. And the last observation that I want to make is this. Some people complain that in the New Testament, we don't get anything from Jesus himself. So we really don't have access to Jesus. There's not, you know, Jesus didn't write Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. Jesus didn't write any of the epistles of the New Testament. There is no piece of the New Testament that is written by Jesus himself. Everything is mediated or presented to us through someone else's experience of Jesus. So the argument is we don't get access to Jesus this way. And this is just, for lack of a better description, faulty thinking. Just because Jesus doesn't tell us about who he is directly in the New Testament doesn't mean we don't have access to Jesus. What we have access to, and this is actually important to have, are a variety of impressions that Jesus made on a variety of people in the impact of his ministry. That's actually helpful to have what other people thought and heard and saw Jesus do and say. That's what we have in the Gospels. And we have multiple angles, and that's very, very helpful to us. I like to use this picture on why we have four Gospels rather than just one. And there was, very early on, a desire in the church to move towards telling the story as one running story. A man named Tatian, in the latter part of the second century, wrote a work called the Diatessaron. That means through the four. That tells us two things. One, the four Gospels were the major sources for who Jesus was by the time Tatian was writing the latter part of the second century. And the second thing that it shows us is this desire to try and put all the Gospels together into one pot. I call it a gospel stew. Okay, a little bit of Matthew, a little bit of Mark, a little bit of Luke, and a little bit of John. Stir up and serve it. Okay, so, you know, heat for 30 minutes and then, you know, give it to people. So, gospel stew. And we want to tell the story in one running account. Well, Tatian's idea was, let's take this stuff that we have in the four Gospels and tell it in one running account, and he presented this to the church, and it never replaced the four Gospels. It did come to have a significant role in the Syrian church, but it never replaced the four Gospels. And here's why. There is value in having multiple angles on Jesus. And here's the analogy. And I like to use sports whenever possible. In the NFL, you know that we've been dealing with instant replay for a long time. Now, in the early days, instant replay just had a handful of cameras. Now, instant replay is able to utilize multiple cameras. The more cameras we have looking at the play, the better chance that one angle will give us a look at the play that the other cameras won't give us. Okay? I think you can think of the Gospels in the same kind of way. We've got multiple impact accounts of how Jesus impacted people, different people with different interests, all drawn to the same Lord, all observing, in some cases, the same thing about Jesus, and in other cases, different things about Jesus, but those differences are not necessarily contradictions. They can be complementary observations about what Jesus did, what Jesus said, what Jesus taught. That's what we get in the gospel. So it's like having multiple camera angles for instant replay. And there's value in how each writer gives us, at least to some degree, a unique take on Jesus while also overlapping at the same time with the other Gospels. So these differences don't need to be a problem. They can actually be a way of opening up, if you will, a kind of three-dimensional view of Jesus, whereas if we only had one account of him from one author, that risks being one-dimensional. So that's why we have multiple Gospels, and that's why I think we have material from different writers and the different impacts that he has. All right. So all this has been a huge buildup. I broke every homiletical rule in the book by having a mega introduction. Okay? Now let's take a look at some specifics. And what we're going to look at are parallels where we've got the same story, but we've got different details. And what you're going to see is the New Testament pretty consistently works with what I call variation and gist. Tells the story with a little bit of variation, but the core of the story is doing the same thing. Okay? And what I want to argue is that difference does not equal contradiction. It equals difference. It's complementary, not contradictory. Okay? So that's where we're going. Let me give you some examples. And for this, we are going to use the scripture. So if you have a biblical text in front of you, this will help. So turn with me. Let's start first with the parable of the soils. I'm going to start off in Mark 4:14. And first, I'm going to read you, I'm going to keep this simple. First, I'm going to read you the version in Mark, and then I'm going to read you the version in Luke. And you will see this variation and gist. Here is the version in Mark, and we're looking at the part of the parable where Jesus is interpreting the parable and telling us what represents what. Okay, Mark 4:14. The sower sows the word. These are the ones on the path where the word is sown. And whenever they hear, immediately Satan comes and snatches the word that was sown in them. These are the ones sown on the rocky ground. As soon as they hear the word, they receive it with joy, but they have no root in themselves and do not endure. Then, when trouble or persecution comes because of the word, immediately they fall away. Others are the ones sown among the thorns. They are those who hear the word, but worldly cares, the seductiveness of wealth, and the desire of other things come in and choke the word, and it produces nothing. But these are the ones sown on the good soil. They hear the word and receive it and bear fruit, 130 times as much, 160, 100. Okay? Standard rendering of the four soils, one on the road, one among rocky ground, one among the thorns, and then the one in the good soil. Okay, now, let's go to Luke. Luke chapter 8. And we'll start in verse 11. Now, I want you to see variation in gist. Just keep your ears open based upon what we just read. Now, the parable means this. The seed is the word of God. Those along the path are the ones who have heard. Then the devil comes. Now, that isn't the word that Mark used. Mark used the word Satan. Okay? Same thing, but variation. The devil comes and takes away the word from their hearts so they may not believe and be saved. Those on the rock are the ones who receive the word with joy when they hear it. They have no root. They believe for a while, but in the time of testing, not persecution, same thing, different words. As for the seed that fell among the thorns, these are the ones who hear, but as they go on their way, they are choked by the worries, riches, and pleasures of life. Shortened form of the threefold list we got in Mark. And their fruit does not mature, okay, as opposed to bears nothing. Same idea, different words. But as for the seed that landed on the good soil, these are the ones who, after hearing, cling to it with an honest and good heart, more detail than Mark gave us, and bear fruit with steadfast endurance. Nothing about the different yields that we got in Mark. Okay? So what you have is variation and gist. Gist of the parable is the same. Same four soils. Same four categories, but differences in the wording, slightly different, but saying the same thing. Okay, that's the parable of the soils. Let me give you another one that's kind of fun. This one's interesting. This is Matthew 8 and Luke 7. And this is the healing of the centurion's servant that we're looking at. It's an interesting text. And I'll summarize the difference. I'm not going to read the passage to you. I'm going to summarize the difference. In Matthew, the centurion and Jesus have a direct conversation with one another. Okay, so in verse 5, it says, when he entered Capernaum, chapter 8 of Matthew, when he entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed in terrible anguish. Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. But the centurion replied, Lord, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof, and said, just say the word and my servant will be healed. I'm to a man under authority. Jesus speaks the word, the servant is healed. And Jesus also says, I haven't found such faith like this in Israel. Okay, Luke. This is Luke chapter 7. You go to Luke 7, and there's a little interesting detail. Luke 7, verse 1. After Jesus had finished teaching all this to the people, he entered Capernaum. A centurion there had a slave who was highly regarded, but who was sick at the point of death. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders to him, asking him to come and heal his slave. When they came to Jesus, they urged him earnestly, he is worthy to have you do this for him because he loves our nation, even built our synagogue. So Jesus went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him saying, do not trouble yourself. I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not presume to come to you. Instead, say the word and my servant will be healed. We get the word of authority. Jesus speaks the word. The servant's healed. And Jesus says, I haven't seen such faith in Israel. Two very interesting accounts of this one healing with a significant variation. In one, messengers are sent on behalf of the centurion to talk to Jesus. In the other, it's portrayed as a face-to-face conversation. Now, the important observation to make is that in Matthew, this scene comes right after the Sermon on the Mount. And in Luke, this scene comes right after the Sermon on the Plain, which is Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount. In other words, they have the same location in these two Gospels. So, it looks, smells, it passes the taste test, the smell test. This is the same event. It's being described with two distinct sets of details. What's going on? Well, this is an example of where we see and need to appreciate the Gospels as literary narratives in which authors make choices. And what Matthew has done is he has culturally simplified the story. Because in the ancient world, if you sent a messenger in your name, that was regarded as being as good as being there yourself. Jesus even said this about the apostles. Okay? I send you, the one who hears you hears me, and the one who hears me hears the one who sent me. Okay? That's the shaliach, or sent one, principle. So what Matthew's done is he simplified the story, and in effect, in the mouths of the messengers, is the centurion's face-to-face encounter with Jesus, because they are representing what he sent them to do. We actually do this today, we just don't think about it. When the press secretary speaks in Washington, D.C., we don't care who the press secretary is. In fact, many of us probably don't even know his name. But the fact that he has White House hovering over his head tells us that what he says is significant because he is representing and communicating on behalf of the President of the United States. So, it's an example of the same kind of thing. So what Matthew has done is to simplify the story. Luke is actually concerned, in part, with the evidence of reconciliation, a healthy relationship between Jews and Gentiles that this event also represents. Matthew's only interested in the miracle, and the miracle for the centurion's son, so he simplifies it. This is actually the first of several places where Matthew simplifies something that we meet in more detail elsewhere in another gospel. I'm going to give you another example in a minute with Jairus' daughter. So this is a case of literary compression. Now, watch this. Luke's version of the miracle is more precise than Matthew's version is. Okay, because we've got the interjection of the messengers or the emissaries sent on the centurion's behalf. That's a detail Matthew doesn't have. But both accounts are accurate. Jesus healed the centurion's son at the request and initiative of a centurion who asked Jesus for healing through emissaries in one account, directly in the other. And the faith of the centurion was praised by Jesus as being unlike that seen anywhere else in Israel. Variation and gist. Not contradictory, complementary. Complementary when seen in light of the literary kind of moves that that literature and narrative writers often make in making choices. Okay, that's the healing of the centurion slave. Another example, same kind of thing. Again, showing that chronology doesn't always matter. The order of the temptations is different in Matthew versus Luke. In Mark, we only get the mention that Jesus was tempted for 40 days. But in Matthew and in Luke, we get three temptations each. Okay, take a look at this. In Matthew 4, verse 1, we get this order. We get turn the stones into bread. The second temptation in Matthew is what I call the miraculous dive. Okay, you're supposed to dive off the edge of the temple, and God's going to protect you on the dive. You know, it's a 3.5 revolutions with a twist, and it's 3.4 degrees of difficulty, and God's going to protect him on the way down. Okay, that's the second scene. The third scene is the request to worship the devil. So we've got stones to bread, swan dive, and then worship me. Go to Luke. We're also in Luke 4, starting in verse 1. Okay, the first temptation is the same. Okay, it's turn these stones into bread. The second temptation is the offer to worship Satan, and I will give you all the world. And the third temptation is the swan dive off the edge of the temple. So what is 1:2:3 in Matthew is 1:3:2 in Luke. Obviously, chronology didn't matter to somebody. Okay, I don't think we want to argue that there were six temptations, two of which paired up, they were the same, and there were actually six temptations done in different orders, and combine it that way. No, what's probably happened is one of the authors, for literary reasons, has moved the order of the temptation. In fact, we think it's Luke, because Luke puts the Jerusalem temptation, the temple temptation at the end, and Jerusalem is an important geographic locale for what's going to happen to Jesus. In Luke's gospel, he has a whole section called the Journey to Jerusalem section in which he highlights the fact that Jesus is going to Jerusalem to meet his death over and over and over again, six times in that section from Luke 9 to Luke 19. The bulk of the unique Lucan material is in that section, and so we think he's responsible for making the order. And in fact, if you read those two accounts more carefully, you will find that at the end of the third temptation in Matthew, Jesus dismisses Satan from his midst. That's not in Luke. Okay? Variation and gist. Okay? I hope you're getting the gist of what I'm doing. Okay? Here's next. Some more. The opening of the Olivet Discourse. Okay? The speech that Jesus gives about the end. This is an interesting one. I don't have time to go through all that's happening here. But just let's start with Mark first. Go to Mark 13. Verse 3. So while he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, opposite the temple, Peter, James, and John, and Andrew asked him privately, start in verse 1. Now, as Jesus was going out of the temple courts, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, look at these tremendous stones and buildings." There was a building project to expand the Temple Mount underway during this time that Herod was undertaking. And it was the, Israelis' tax dollars at work. And they're impressed with what is happening to the temple as it's being rebuilt and refurbished and expanded.
Teacher, look at these tremendous stones and buildings. Jesus said to him, do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left on another, and all will be torn down. He predicts the destruction of the temple in Mark 13:2. Now, verse 3. So while he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, and John and Andrew asked him privately, tell us, question number one, when will these things happen? And two, what will be the sign all these things are about to take place? Two questions. When will this happen? What are the signs? Okay, let's go to Luke. Luke 21. Verse 5. Now, while some were speaking about the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and offerings, Jesus said, as for these things you are gazing at, the days will come when not one stone will be left on another, all will be torn down. So they asked him, teacher, when will these things happen? What will be the sign these things are about to take place? Same two questions you have in Mark. Okay, when is this going to happen? What's going to be the sign all this is going to happen? Now the fun. Go to Matthew. Verse 1, chapter 24. Matthew 24, verse 1. Now, as Jesus was going out of the temple courts and walking away, his disciples came to show him the temple buildings, and he said to them, do you see all these things? I tell you the truth, not one stone will be left on another. All will be torn down. Verse 3, as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, his disciples came to him privately. Notice, Matthew doesn't specify who the disciples are. He just says the disciples. In Mark, we were told, the four disciples who asked this question of Jesus, variation and gist. Okay, his disciples came to him and said, tell us, when will these things happen? Just like Mark, just like Luke. And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Whoops! Okay, not when will be the sign all these things will happen, but what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Matthew's actually throwing the question out in such a way that it's clear he's talking ultimately about the end. That is something explicit in Matthew that is implicit in Mark and Luke, but it's not in Mark and Luke's form of the question. Variation and gist with things that are said. Okay, the next example is the placement of Jesus' Nazareth synagogue speech. I've already mentioned this one. This is in Mark 6 and in Matthew 13, smack in the middle of Matthew's gospel. First thing in the Galilean ministry in Luke, with the mention to Capernaum. And if you read on in Luke 4, Jesus goes to Capernaum after that synagogue speech. And it's his first time there. That's for literary rearrangement. Not a contradiction, just a way of doing things. I've already talked about the topical arrangement of controversies. Those five controversies in Mark 2:1 to 3:5, five controversies right in a row. Healing of the paralytic, Jesus' association with tax collectors and sinners, Jesus doesn't fast and pray in the way that's like John's disciples and the Pharisees, and two Sabbath controversies. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These are five things that got Jesus into trouble. That's what Mark's doing. Luke's doing the same thing. In Matthew 8 to 12, you get those five things in that order, by the way. Okay, but with all kinds of things in between so that it stretches across five chapters. These are literary choices that are producing differences. So what in the world is going on? I got two more. Jairus' daughter. This is an interesting one. You know this story. I like telling this story. I like telling this story particularly from the viewpoint of Jairus. You know, Jairus comes to Jesus and says, at least in the Lucan version and in the Markan version, my daughter's dying, please come and heal her. And Jesus decides to go with Jairus to his house to heal his daughter. On the way, he gets touched in what I call an attempt at a guerrilla healing, okay, by a woman with hemorrhaging blood who's supposed to be indicating that she's unclean as she moves through the crowds, but she doesn't. But she does this kind of guerrilla move where she says, if I just touch the garment of Jesus, I'll be healed. And so she runs up and touches him and tries to get away, only Jesus says, well,
Someone touched me. And of course, in one of the accounts, Peter says, Lord, the crowd's all around us. What do you mean someone touched you? And of course, he draws her out. Meanwhile, Jairus is waiting for Jesus to go to his house to heal his very sick daughter. And while Jesus is in this conversation with this woman, a servant comes from the house and says, don't trouble the master anymore. She's died. And the reason I like this passage so much is, imagine you're Jairus when this is going on, and he's having the conversation with this woman. And it's a little bit like being stuck in traffic and you're running late. Okay, only it's worse. Okay, you know, going to the same place as 500,000 of your closest friends do when you're in L.A. Okay, and you're frustrated because you're running behind, you're not going to get there on time, and you want to get there. And so Jesus is, you know, Jairus is hung up in traffic when this healing's going on. And then the messenger comes, says, don't trouble him anymore. Your daughter's dead. And then, of course, Jesus goes on and says, she's only sleeping, gets the crowd to laugh, goes in, heals her, and that's the story. That's the story in Mark and Luke. Okay, turn with me to Matthew. And we are in Matthew, I think it's 8, if I'm not mistaken. No, Matthew 9. Matthew 9:18. Now remember I told you how Matthew collapses stories? He simplifies them. Look what he does with this. As he was saying these things, Jesus was teaching about old wine being put into new wineskins. Okay, remember that series of 5 controversies? One of the controversies is that Jesus doesn't fast and pray like John the Baptist and the Pharisees do. And so Jesus answers this question by saying, you know, you don't put old wine new wine into old wineskins. Okay, that's the answer Jesus is giving here. Now, this story is not juxtaposed to that saying in either Luke or Mark, but it is here in Matthew. And so it says, as he was saying these things, a ruler came, bowed low before him and said, watch this, my daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and she will live. And Jesus and his disciples got up and followed him, but a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhage, and then the rest of it is a double miracle, just like you get in Mark and in Luke. So, in Matthew's telling, we have the girl framed in the story as dead from the beginning. In Luke and in Mark's story, she dies while Jesus is on the way to the house. What's going on? What's going on, as I said, is Matthew's tendency to literally simplify the story. What's important to Matthew is, by the time Jesus gets to Jairus' house, the girl is dead. And the miracle involves a dead girl. That she died along the way is not important to Matthew. What's important to Matthew is she was dead by the time Jesus got there. So the request in total, in light of the totality of the experience, was, Jesus, come heal my dead daughter. Even though in the details, that was something that came to be realized in the middle of the story. Mark and Luke give us more detail and are more precise, but Matthew is accurate because Jesus raised a dead girl at the end of the story. Okay? That's the kind of variation that we're talking about. Okay. Another one is the cursing of the fig tree. In the 2 versions, in one version, Jesus curses the fig tree and it immediately withers. Boom. In the variation, Jesus curses the fig tree. The next morning when they come back, the fig tree's withered. Now, here's the question. How fast is immediately? How fast is immediately? How long does it take to kill vegetation? All right? One is a summary. The other is the detail. Variation and gist.
Now, what am I saying? Okay, because I've been going long and hard, and you're getting tired of all these examples. Because as I'm suggesting to you, they happen often, frequently. What we are seeing is the way the Gospels are written and the way the Gospels work. What we are seeing is how the inspired text works in terms of its phenomena. And this is the way I like to tell it. Give an illustration. Hopefully you'll remember this, and this will help you think through what's going on. I call it the difference, and I actually owe Mike Lacona this illustration. It's a great illustration. I like to call this, and Mike likes to call this, the difference between guy and gal telling. Now, it isn't quite that clean, but let me explain to you what I mean. If I ask my wife, do I need to be at dinner tonight at 6 o'clock? My wife has this wonderful habit of giving me a detailed answer to my query. And it will go something like this. She will start with my schedule at whatever time I'm getting up in the morning, take me through all the events that I have to go through, and then finally, when she gets to dinner time, she will tell me whether my presence is required or not. I will tell you, it drives me crazy. I've been married to her for 40 years, and she is consistent. She does this all the time. I'll ask her a question, and I'll say, just answer my question, while she leads up to the because what she's giving me is not only the answer to the question, but the rationale for it, okay, which she wants me to appreciate as her loving husband, okay? It's a character development thing, okay? But if you ask me, if my wife asks me, is your presence required at dinner at 6 o'clock, you will get a very crisp answer. In one word, I will either say yes or I will say no. I will not pass go. I will not collect $200. I will not give you all the gory details. I will simply tell you whether your presence is required or not. That's guy versus gal telling. It's just the difference of the way we're made and the way we tick. Now, I have a colleague, and the reason this is not good guy and gal telling is because I have a colleague who's married to a German wife whose relationship is the exact opposite of what I described. I've taught with him for over 30 years. He's a good friend. We teach a class together, exegesis of gospel narrative, and I refer to him lovingly as Dr. Google because he knows more about stuff than you can imagine. And so his German wife is like me. If you ask Ursula, does Hall need to be at dinner at 6 o'clock? She's a German, so she will answer, ja or nein. Okay? Get a yes or a no answer. If you ask Hall whether Ursula needs to be at dinner at 6 o'clock at night, he will start with the history of Greco-Roman hospitality in the ancient world, all right? And he will work his way up to an answer telling you all kinds of fascinating things and then finally telling you whether Ursula should be at dinner or not. Okay? That's guy versus gal. We all are made differently. We tick differently. We pick out different things as important. We tell stories in different ways and in different patterns. And we can talk about the same thing in different ways and still be talking about the same thing. That's guy versus gal telling. And I think that's some of what you see in the variations that you get in the Gospels. That's part of what produces the multiple angles that we're talking about. Okay, I thought I was done with examples, and like a good preacher, I lied. Okay, here are a few more, just to drive home the point. And I'm just gonna pick out one of these. I have three on the slide, but I'm just going to pick out one. Think about the voice from heaven, and what was said to Jesus when he was baptized by John the Baptist. Okay? We're at the same point. Jesus comes up out of the water, and a voice from heaven speaks. In Mark and in Luke, what is said is, you are my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. In Matthew, what is said is, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. In other words, in Mark and in Luke, Jesus is addressed directly. In Matthew, we are told the significance of this address as an aside, it's important to recognize that when this event took place, the only people who were aware of what was going on were Jesus and John the Baptist. The crowds that were around didn't hear or see anything. How do we know that? The Bible tells me so. Okay, if you look at the Gospel of John, it says that John was a witness to who the Christ was. And how was he a witness? The one on whom you see the dove descending is the one who's marked out as the Son of God. John the Baptist is witnessing to something that only he experienced, okay, besides Jesus himself. Okay, so what we have is an affirmation, what we have in the Synoptic Gospels is an affirmation, you are my beloved Son. And really what God is doing at this point is marking out the beginning of Jesus' ministry. It's time to start. You're anointed with the presence of the Spirit. It's time to start your ministry. What Matthew does is to step back and say, here's the significance of this event in light of the fact that most people didn't see it happen. God marked out this one as His Son. Variation? But gist. But here we're getting the significance of what is going on. Okay, I said I was done with my illustrations. I have one last one because I love this one. It's not on the slide. Just thought about including it. Here's one that's interesting. The Lord's Supper. My understanding is that this church, you observe the Lord's Supper every week. Do you realize that in the tradition in the New Testament, there are two versions of what was said at the Last Supper over the elements? There are the versions in Matthew and Mark that match up, and there's the versions in Luke and in 1 Corinthians 11 that match up. Let me show you one of the differences. And it's a wonderful illustration of what we're talking about and how this works. Look at Mark 12. I'm sorry, Mark 14. And look at verse 22 and 23. While they were eating, 14, 22, and 23. While they were eating, he took bread, and after giving thanks, he broke it, gave it to them, and said, "Take it, this is my body." After taking the cup and giving thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. And he said, "This is my blood, the blood of the covenant that is poured out for many." Okay, just remember that phrase, the blood of the covenant. Okay? Go to Luke. Luke chapter 22. And we'll start in verse 19. Then he took bread, and after giving thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And in the same way, he took the cup after they had eaten, saying, "This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood." And then he goes on to talk about the betrayal of Judas. So, this is the covenant in my blood and the new covenant in my blood. What's going on here? This is why I like this one. This is really neat. What Luke is doing, I think, is filling out what Jesus said and meant. There's only one covenant that has not yet been inaugurated out of the covenants of promise in the Old Testament when Jesus ministers. The Abrahamic covenant has been realized. There's been a seed produced for Abraham, and that seed has now produced the Messiah. The Davidic covenant has been realized, and that the king who represents the messianic line of David, who delivers, has been brought to earth. We know that from the genealogies. But the one covenant that has not been inaugurated yet, that has not been established, is the new covenant. The covenant with forgiveness of sins and the idea that God's going to put the law or give the Spirit and put it among people's hearts. That's not been inaugurated yet. Jesus' death sets the stage for forgiveness of sins to inaugurate the new covenant. So there's only one covenant for which the blood needs to be shed to establish that covenant. That one covenant is the new covenant. So here's what I think is going on. And by the way, this works either way, even if my explanation doesn't work. If it's the way I think it happened, Jesus said the blood of the covenant. But he meant the blood of the new covenant, because that's the only covenant that needs to be established. So Mark gives you the words that Jesus uttered, but Luke gives you the meaning of those words. You with me? Okay? Because the covenant that was being alluded to in the blood of the covenant is the blood of the new covenant. Even though Jesus may not have exactly said that, that's what he meant. It's like this sentence. The cowboys are going to the frozen tundra to melt the cheese heads. Okay? It's a very theological statement, by the way. Okay? What topic did I just talk about? American football. How do you know that? American football is not in that sentence. American football is nowhere in that sentence, but that's about American football. You're right. Okay? You know it because you know the concept that is being invoked or is embedded in those words. Okay? So, the blood of the covenant is talking about the new covenant, even though the words new covenant are not explicitly used, because that's the only covenant, culturally, theologically, in the background, that could be alluded to here. So, one explains, and if you will, paraphrases what Jesus says, and the other tells you what Jesus says. Variation and gist. Okay, we've given your mind a workout. Okay, so let me summarize. And that's the difference. Let me say one other thing. You really want to impress people when you have these discussions. Okay, you go to a foreign language. And then if you really want to impress people, you go to a dead foreign language. Okay? And it really works. Okay? This is the difference in what scholars call between abscissima verba and abscissima vox. It's Latin. Okay? The very words of Jesus or the very voice of Jesus. And what I'm saying to you is that sometimes we're getting the voice of Jesus and not always the very words of Jesus, but either way, we're getting the meaning of Jesus. Variation and gist. Okay? So you can throw a Latin phrase on someone and just really blow them away. It's, you know, that was free of charge. Okay, now, here's what I'm saying. You have the right to paraphrase, you have the right to explain, you have the right to rearrange, you have the right to summarize, you even have the right to simplify in the literature that we have. So we're getting some variation in the details, but we're always getting the core gist. And I've given you numerous examples, whether we think about the questions of the Olivet Discourse. I didn't go to Peter's Confession and the Son of Man. Instead, I used the voice of the baptism, but it's making the same point. The wording at the Last Supper, whether we think about topical groupings, that kind of thing. By the way, there's another topical grouping in Mark 8. We get four miracles right in a row. We get the calming of the storm, the healing of the Gerasene demoniac, the healing of the hemorrhaging woman, and Jairus' daughter. Literally, one after another, we deal with creation. We deal with demons, we deal with disease, and then we deal with death. It's kind of an alpha and omega of the range of Jesus' miracles, all put together in Mark, all put together in Luke, scattered in Matthew. Topical grouping. Why do we get four Gospels? We get four Gospels for this variation that we see that allows us to give different angles and emphasize different things between the various accounts. And in the process, we get Jesus not in monophonic sound, we get Jesus in quadraphonic sound. And we get more depth about him as a result. So, I've talked about guy and girl explanation. I've talked about, you know, when did Jairus' daughter die? Who spoke to Jesus as the centurion's son was healed?
All these things show this variation in gist. And what I'm arguing is this. Differences do not equal contradiction, which is what skeptics will do. What they'll do with every one of these examples is, these stories don't agree. There's no way they can work. We can't trust any of it because we can't trust that part of it. And I'm going, it's not that simple, it's not that flat in terms of how it should be read. The approach of the skeptic is to divide and conquer, to argue that the Gospels contradict, and therefore I can't trust them. And what I'm saying to you is, no, the Gospels complement one another, and they can be trusted. These are complementary readings with the Gospels giving different angles. Accuracy is not always precision. That's true, and we need to be aware of that. And vox can count as well as verba. I can get its voice, but I'm still getting what I'm saying. Whether I tell you, by the way, we do this all the time. The president gets up and he gives this illustration worked better when Clinton was president. Okay? He gets up, State of the Union address, and he goes for an hour. Clinton used to go for an hour. Okay? The little 5-minute news summary comes on that evening, and the reporter says, the president told Congress tonight in the State of the Union address that gives one sentence. That exact sentence is nowhere in that hour-long speech, but as long as it's an accurate summary of what the president said, we do not pull our hair out of our head, get my hairline. Okay? We accept it because we understand what he's doing. He's summarizing a longer piece. Sermon on the Mount, wonderful illustration. You know how long it takes to read the Sermon on the Mount? 7 minutes. Sermon on the Mount was probably much longer than that. They were out there. We know when Jesus ministered to people and he gathered the various cities, he was out there for a long time. I tell my students, if the Sermon on the Mount is the model for preaching, all our church services would be much shorter. Who gets up and preaches for 7 minutes? So, realize what the Gospels are doing. They are summarizing, presenting, sometimes quoting, sometimes paraphrasing Jesus. We get variation in the way the stories are told, but the gist that we get within those stories is giving us the same story. I took a long time to do that. I ran a little longer than I planned to, but that's the presentation on variations and differences in the gospel. Variation in gist is what you want to think about. And with that, you've earned a meal. So it's break and brunch time, I think, is the way we've got this scheduled, right? Am I right about that?